I have put out for you a pamphlet, and this is the first time that I've done a pamphlet for quite a long time, and we'll go through this pamphlet today. I want you to be able to appreciate a certain tone of language. The difference between a magical language and a mythical language. I'll give you a rule of thumb, which you might be able to help yourself with. The ancient Hermes, the first Hermes, used mythic language. Hermes Trismegistus used magical language. The difference between the original Hermes in archaic times and Hermes Trismegistus in Hellenistic times was that the first one used mythic language, the second one used magical language. Question. Where in between the original Hermes and Hermes thrice greatest, what about the double Hermes? What about the second Hermes? Hermes Trismegistus is the grandson, in a way, of the original Hermes of Thoth. Hermes Trismegistus is the grandson of Thoth, who is the son of Thoth, who is the father of Hermes. Answer, unknown. Question, why unknown? Answer, not able to be identified ever. Question, what? Answer, you heard me. What is in between the original Hermes, Thoth, who spoke mythic language, and the third Hermes, Hermes Trismegistus, who spoke magical language, is unknowable. The first Hermes belongs to myth. The third Hermes belongs to history. The second Hermes belongs to the deep self and is not knowable in any discursive way, is not able to be differentiated. So always, in classical wisdom traditions of the High Dharma of the West, there was the sense that Hermes Trismegistus was a very mysterious figure whose father is an unknown god. No one knows. Now, I've put on the cover of this pamphlet a pastiche of images, and you can see the original Hermes as Thoth holding up a tablet, and you can see Hermes Trismegistus in the classic High Renaissance portrayal here, which is in the pavement of the Siena Cathedral, Siena, Italy. Siena is south of Florence by not very far, in the next neighboring province, not in Tuscany, but in Siena. The great book on Siena in the Renaissance is by Ferdinand Chaville, simply called Siena. We have a copy here someplace. The Hermes Trismegistus that you see here in the Siena pavement also appears on the book plate of the Philosophic Research Society, which Manly Hall chose to be the central synthesizing symbol for the books in the library, the book plates in the library of the Philosophic Research Society here in Los Angeles. I don't know if you know, but Mr. Hall has one of the world's largest collections of book plates book plates to him are esoteric emblems of intellectual syntheses. And so his choice of this book plate is extraordinarily packed with meaning. In between Thoth and Hermes Trismegistus is a definite stage which would be occupied by a figure, is occupied by a figure, but that figure is not knowable. That figure is the deep self, which although it exists, does not exist in a way which can be talked about. That is to say, its existence is an occurrence and has no objective reality distinct from its subjective happening. That the objective and subjective are in complete balance so as to be indistinguishable, so that one cannot have any way to be discursive or to be subjective. Notice it works both ways. One does not know in the experience, and one does not know before or after the experience. One cannot know projectively in an objective way, and one cannot know while there subjectively either. Not knowable. Now in the West, this stateless state was never examined in public. The classic high Dharma way of talking in the Hermetic treatises occurs in the Hermetic dialogue called the Crater, or sometimes translated as the Basin. It meant a kylix, kind of a bowl that had a double handle, which if you took the bowl away and put the handle together, it made an infinity sign. So that when you saw the infinity sign in Hermetic arcane way, that was the handle on the crater, the mixing bowl, wherein the no mind is made by putting equal amounts of subjective and objective together and having something other than either. The second Hermes belongs to that realm, realmless realm. Now in the Eastern tradition, the Mahayana explored that realm more than any other human endeavor has ever done. And the exploration has never been given its full story. I tried to give a symbolic insight into an approach to that story about 5 years ago in a lecture series at the Philosophic Research Society called Bodhisattvas, in which I took a sequence from the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle-length sayings of the Buddha, 10 in a row. The way in which the Buddha taught was to put a sequence and to allow the sequence to end abruptly so that you yourself would be hierophantically asked to continue the sequence, but where the Buddha would leave the sequence off is right at the threshold of the deep self, so that when you would go to continue the sequence, you would experience that this sequence, when it is continued, does not occur discursively. It was a way of enlightenment. And I tried to reproduce that in the Bodhisattva's lecture series about 5 years ago. There are 13 cassettes there. And they're around here someplace. The Mahayana, using the Hermetic Greek fire, as it were, the sense of refining fire, before it was in alchemy, it was Hermetic Greek way of saying to continue even though nothing is happening, which requires a very peculiar state of mind. It requires a mind in complete tranquility to keep on going when you understand that nothing is occurring. But that in this condition, in this stateless condition, that's exactly what you want to pay attention to, that nothing is happening. And you want to note and see, and the art of it is that nothing continues to happen. And as soon as anything does start to happen, you know you're off the path. You know that you're degenerating or you're evolving, and both the degeneracy and the evolving are errors. As soon as anything begins to occur, the first indication that something is occurring, either degeneratively or evolutionally, is that the mind begins to register images long before the body begins to have any kind of feeling tone. The mind will register images. And the first images that occur are geometricities. The deepest pictures in the mind are geometricities. So that, please try to hear this, so that geometry as an ancient Hermetic science was a mind discipline to train you to carry your mental imagery to the structural foundations. And by retracing the differentiation of the science of geometry, by retracing it and going back to the more primordial axioms of geometry, you were taking the foundations of the mind's imagery back to its elementary components. And that the axiomatic basis of geometry in the high Hellenistic Hermetic mode was that all of the axioms reduce back to one single point. So that if you were to open the high Hermetic geometric textbook written by Euclid in Alexandria about 270 BC, you would notice that the first statement is that we begin with a point, and a point is a location that has no dimension. You begin in the equanimity of the deep self, where there is no objective discursive possibility whatsoever, and also no subjective experience whatsoever also. So that the science of geometry was a way of unfolding what comes out of what does not register. That all of this geometricity comes out of what does not register shows that what does not register is not nothing, but is proteinly full. And thus, the Hellenistic Hermetic term, pleroma, the fullness. The goddamn point is full of every shape possible. It has no dimension. I'm trying to put a little rasp to it in Hollywood style so that you confront this, because there's resistances all the time in the mind for doing this. Why? Because the mind is made to go out to differentiate. It doesn't want to turn back yet. You have to grab the mind by its horns and wrestle it down and hog tie its kicking feet, because it will not of its own go back. It wants to go on. Retreat, you say? The hell you say? Thus saith the mind. Notice that differentiation when it's reversed. When you retrace differentiation, that mode is a natural integration. When you turn around the mind from its natural concourse and reverse it, you no longer have differentiation, but you have integration. Now, the mind naturally does not integrate. The mind naturally differentiates. So that when it moves into an integration mode, the mind to itself is surreal. Its experience of itself is that this is really a wonderland. It's a mystery. Look what I'm doing. Look, Ma, no pictures. So that the integrating mind now is a supernatural occurrence. But it has a most remarkable affinity. The integrating mind has an affinity with some other, quote, organ, which naturally integrates. What is that organ that naturally integrates? It's the heart. So that the integrating mind is now affine to the integrating heart. The heart is natural, the mind supernatural. Now, if you find yourself as a being with a natural heart and a supernatural mind, that's what a bodhisattva is. That's why the picture of a bodhisattva shows a very physically mobile, athletic body whose clothes are not subject to gravity anymore and just float up in huge draperies, carrying these Central Asian mandolins that play all kinds of musical modes that you've never heard before. Modes based on permutations of the Mixolydian that sound rather enticing and odd to the Western ear. Those are the melodies of the integrating mind. Notice here, though, remind yourselves that the mind does not integrate naturally. Will not do it. You must discipline the mind in order for it to integrate. So that the off comments from so-called New Age teachers about integrating the mind are just so much gibberish unless they really mean it. And if they really mean it, they would be very careful about talking in this way. Now, in the crater, in the basin, in that hermetic treatise, which is in the Corpus Hermeticum, I think it's the fourth or the fifth that is in the standard sequence now. They had no sequence particularly, except that the Poimandres was always the greatest and therefore was first in later. But in the crater, when Hermes Trismegistus is teaching his son, Tot, notice that his son, Tot, would be the fourth Hermes. Those who have come in late are missing the context of this. The whole context is that while there is an original Hermes, Thoth, and there is a Hermes Trismegistus, the third, there is no identifiable second Hermes. The only way that we can denote the second Hermes is to denote the fact that we know that he is not expressible, even though he does occur. And so he has to be denoted symbolically only, cannot be existentially denoted, but can only be symbolically denoted. So that the second Hermes is delineated by the handles of the mixing bowl, called in Western occult lore the crater, called in its alchemical mode the crucible, called sometimes in academic transformations the basin. It has religious overtones. One is baptized out of water that comes from the basin. Now don't go religious on me. Stop that. The original basin was the Jordan River. The original basin is a river. That river, why? Why the Jordan? It flows from a spring that comes from the roots of Mount Hermon, and it flows into the Dead Sea, and that's it. One can stand at a certain point and see the origins and the end of the Jordan River. One can see the whole ecology from spring to the end. Did you not know that? Well, Jesus used to meditate on that mountain. That's the very mountain where Elijah rose to heaven in a chariot of fire. It doesn't even have a name. It never had a name. It's just the high rise of land past the old Jericho ford of the Jordan River, up a little creeklet, which is usually dry some parts of the year. So the original crater, the original basin, the original crucible is not even a bowl. Although in the Hermetic lore, which goes back to Egypt, where the river, the Nile, the Jordan is a symbolic Nile, in Egypt one could not, unless one were in a satellite from the 1990s, one could not see both ends of the Nile. So one had to have a symbol, which was the water of the Nile, since at any point on the Nile, this water has obviously flowed from the beginning and is going to flow to the end, so any water of the Nile will do. So whatever holds an example of the water of the Nile, and the original vessel for that was two hands. And that became a crater, a basin, a bowl. But in the high Greek Hermetic Dharma, the bowl was called a kylix and had two handles on it. And so symbolically, when you vanished the bowl, to be symbolically accurate about this is the second Hermes, all you were left was the handles. And when they go together, it makes the infinity sign. So the second Hermes was symbolically denoted by an infinity sign. So you had Thoth, for whom there is an image. Thoth's image is always writing. Always writing it down. It's the mastery of spoken language being translated into written language. It's the fullness of mythic language achieving its capacity to be magical. What is written has a kind of an occult power that what is said does not have. What is said makes nature. What is written can make the supernatural. What is said can mature a self, but you cannot tell someone how to reverse the flow of the mind so that the mind integrates and comes back to the deep self. That you cannot do by story, by telling. You have to do it by writing. And you have to write in such a way that the integration mode of the mind kicks in, a symbolic writing. It's different. So the first Hermes, Thoth, can be imaged. The third Hermes can be imaged here on the cover. That's for somebody who's light there. There on the cover is Hermes Trismegistus from the Siena Cathedral pavement. So you would have Thoth, the infinity sign, Hermes Trismegistus, and then the fourth Hermes would be the student, the sun. Notice that the relationship of teacher to student here is archetypally father to son. You must understand it can be mother to daughter. It can be father to daughter. It can be mother to son. The simplest, clearest, purest way of just expressing it is father to son. So that the student is the fourth Hermes. Let's count. The first Hermes is myth, which comes out of the ritual comportment. The first Hermes is a mask. Quite real, but on the mask level. The second Hermes is the deep self, unexpressible either objectively or subjectively. The third Hermes is the person, and the fourth Hermes is the spirit. So that when we apprentice ourselves in this high Dharma Hermetic tradition, we complete the quaternary of reality. But we do it only when we are legitimately the fourth element, the completing element. This is why dedication was just, and diligence were just everything. Now I mention at every beginning of the cycle, the only thing you have to do is to provide continuity. When you're in a learning pattern, which is characteristically complete, and have a teacher who can handle the whole pattern, all you have to do is to complete it by your diligence, your continuity. And if you do, the magic works. But nowhere in the pattern can your diligence be supplied to you. You must supply it. You must offer it. So that, for instance, in the ancient Indian yoga tradition, what did the student bring to the teacher? Brought fuel. If you look in the Rig Veda, or any of the Vedas, what does the student bring to the teacher? Fuel. It's symbolic. It's the only thing that the student can bring. If the teacher is together, the teacher is like blast furnace that will turn iron ore into steel. But you have to bring the fuel, because the furnace only works when you bring fuel. If you don't bring any, then it doesn't work. Doesn't mean that it's not there. It means that for you, it didn't work. That's the nature of it. It has to be that way. There's no amount of compassion that someone can do that for you. That would be compassionless to do it all for you. That would truly be a horrendous error. And the so-called New Age teachers who do it all for you are bastards. That's a technical word here. So that in the crater, in the Hermetic dialogue, where Hermes Trismegistus is teaching Thoth, there's a particular shift in the dialogue there's the Neoplatonic Hermetic dialogue going on. And at a certain point, the shift occurs when we are told that now the language is occurring as a torrent which in its rushing outstrips the student's ability to comprehend. And also outstrips the teacher's ability to comprehend. Neither the student nor the teacher can comprehend in that rush. That uncomprehending rush is the Holy Spirit. In Hebrew, ruach. It's the rush of a wind that nobody knows where it came and nobody knows where it's going. No one knows. No one knows that. That is not knowable. The fact that it does occur is incontestable. It's the transmission from the second Hermes, which, quote, is buried so deep that no one knows that it's there. All you can know is by the indications that it did occur. So that the deep self is like unconscious. I'm using that technically now too. But the spirit is superconscious, but has the same character as the deep self in the unconscious. It has the same mysteriousness that no one knows, only this time one is quite conscious of the fact that you in this mode are unknowable. No one is ever going to be able to know you in that mode. It's like the last trigger of non-egoity. You're going to have trouble spelling that, somebody. The last vestige of losing the ego is to realize that in your completest, most glorious, triumphant reality, no one will ever know you in that way, not even yourself. And you will know that quite distinctly. The motive for huffiness is all gone at that point. There's no sense in getting too huffy about anything. Because there isn't anything that's going to match that or even come close. And you might as well just, as the 10th frame in Takuan's sequence on the 10 bulls, you might as well go back to the village and drink with the butchers. Because it's not really going to do anything to you. You can eat red meat. It's whatever it is. The apocryphal story of the Buddha holding out the begging bowl, and you're supposed to take only whatever they put in the bowl. That's what you take. You would take it one time during the day, usually around the 11 o'clock hour. And you would eat, and that would be your single meal for the day. And whatever was put in the bowl, you ate that. And one day he was going around in this village, and this old leper was dishing up some dal, and when putting it into the bowl, one of the fingers fell off and went into the bowl. Lunchtime, Jerry. In the spirit, nothing is impure. But to not understand how that is a very grave error. The classic term for that is encratic. To live as if nothing were impure and not be there is a very, very great, that's Christian esoteric theology, it's called the sin against the Holy Spirit. It's very grave. In Buddhism, this is the threshold to the avisi hell. There are 57 states of feeling, tone, consciousness, only three of which are painful, and the avisi hell is the one that you don't want to get into. That takes a real masterful yogi to deal with that. In the crater, in the hermetic dialogue of the basin, the rush of that language which outstrips the teacher and the student is the push of magical language to its asymptotic ultimate. When you push natural language to its ultimate, the deep self occurs. A natural language, which has nature as its referent, can integrate all of nature to a single point. You can understand from this what an implosive powerfulness the self is. All of the possible meaning of the entire range of nature is brought together in a single focus. It beggars the imagination to even conceive of any fraction of that power, of that dynamis. I mean, tongues are out. When you push a magical language to that extent, the flaming bird of the spirit soars and is that rush which outstrips the teacher and the student. The language itself catches fire in a supernatural way and disappears into the unknown, leaving shreds of question marks and exclamation marks snowing in a landscape of the cosmos. And as they fall, the little exclamation marks and question marks become little flowers. And in the Vimalakirti Sutra, fake spiritual teachers keep trying to brush these flowers that are sticking to them off. And that's how you know that they're fakes, because they... The rain of truth appears to them as inconvenient lice. God's sense of humor is very deep. Let's take a break. Let us continue. Now, what was delivered to you before the break is a horizon which includes self and spirit, which includes symbol and science. So that, for instance, if you look at the collage on the cover of this handout, you'll notice that up near the top is the bar, the tandem of science and symbol, of spirit and self, of cosmos and meaning. And that bar is an excerpt from our mandala. So that was what was said this morning is an indication, a preparation, so that you could focus yourself on the most difficult of all the horizons, the horizon of self and spirit. Now, for many, it will just simply pass over them. It'll just be a tingle on the outside of the ear. But if you're following, you're able now to understand that that horizon between symbol and science between self and spirit, crosses the horizon of art and ritual. And if your memory is operative, you remember that last week, just exactly last week, we were talking about art and ritual, about the mask and the person, about action and patterns, so that were you to, in an attentive fashion, to play for yourself last week's tape, and then sit quietly for a few minutes and then play this week's tape, those two tapes would make an X, which marks the spot. And that X is the interior structure, the interior structure of reality. The exterior structure of reality would be the quaternary nature, myth, magic, and history. Sensation, feeling, insight, and thinking. So that the four functions are an exteriority. They're the configured shape. But the interior structure can only be discerned if one makes the exteriority transparent, or somehow one is able to go in and see the structure within. Now, pursuant to that particular point, I've produced evidence. Exhibit A, virtually Exhibit A, which is on the table, which the perspicuity of those diligent souls has already picked out. And you can see a young green specimen of a branch of a cactus. It's not just any cactus, incidentally. It's a special kind of cactus. It's the first man-made plant since the development of bread wheat long, long, long time ago. This cactus was made by Luther Burbank, made in Santa Rosa, California. It's a hybrid of a natural kind of a cactus, and this cactus was made so that it would not grow spikes or thorns and would be fodder for cattle on the desert, that you could raise animals on the desert. And you wouldn't have to plow the desert under to raise grass, so you could have cattle. You wouldn't have to plow the rainforests under so you could plant grass, so you could have cattle. But you could raise your domestic animals on hybrids of the natural plants and not destroy the environment. It seems like it might be an even protean idea to approach the Brazilian government and tell them that the problem has already been solved by a Californian long time ago, Luther Burbank. Be that as it may, this cactus has an interior structure. And I've given you, we can change our cassettes here.